Right, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. Welcome to the London School of Economics. It's my pleasure to welcome you together with so many colleagues here from the school and from other organizations with which we work. I've just made all the slides go forward, which wasn't the intention. My name is Ricky Burdett, and I'm Professor of Urban Studies here at the school, and together with Philip Rode, I run the Urban Age and the LSE Cities program. This is a program which has created a series of investigations, a series of conferences, an enormous amount of research, which tonight we're actually celebrating together with our co-organizers of the Alfred Herrhausen Society, one of Deutsche Bank's organizations which funds research and cultural activities. And in fact, the welcome, therefore, is not just from Philip and myself and others here, but also from Ute Wieland and Thomas Matusek, the directors of that institution. As I said before, we're actually celebrating 10 years of the Urban Age. And the Urban Age is about this. It's about this slide. It's about where you can see in yellow from the back of the room, not just the T-shirts, in fact, of the stewards tonight, but also where the UN suggests population is going to grow over the next 15 to 20 years. We started, in fact, in 2005 in New York. We've been to 13 different cities around the world. Last year we were in Delhi, and we've decided to sort of celebrate this event here in London, back home. I mean, there are many reasons for doing that here. One is what London is about. Another thing is that it's the 120th anniversary of the London School of Economics, which was set up then by Fabian socialists to really study urban society and its problems. And actually, all the areas around here had all the problems that the Mumbais, the Shanghais, the Lagoses have today, but 120, 130 years ago. Issues of congestion, of intense change, rapid change, but also issues of how to reinvent the institutions which create democracy and inclusion in the city. So we've come back here to celebrate, and we're doing that with five major events, of which this is the first over the next 10 days. So what has the Urban Age done, and in a way, what are our perspectives before we move on to sort of the real meat of the evening, so to speak? Well, first of all, it's visited, as I say, looked at and analyzed 13 cities around the world. But at the same time, we've also probably altogether looked at something like 40 or 50 different cities in different parts of the globe, as you see. What it's also done, apart from trying to understand, and this is one of the key themes of what we're interested in, what are the relationships between the physicality, the space, the design of a city? This is, Mexico City, 22 million. This is Hong Kong. There are different ways in which you can make cities. These are one of the things at the heart of our visual and intellectual investigations. But we've also done something different, which is not unlike what we're doing tonight, which is to bring into a room people who actually, we can say, after 10 years, normally don't speak to each other. We've brought mayors together with designers. We've brought other policymakers together with academics. It's really quite a range of people, from transport planners to environmentalists, who on the whole tend to speak in different silos. And then, of course, one of the other things we've done is carried out a lot of research. You'll see from the leaflet in front of you, particularly the back cover, which could be a little poster you might want to put up somewhere. For those of you who are really interested in this data, don't try and read it on the screen, but it's the back cover of what you have in front of us. What have we learnt, as I say, from these initiatives which bring research, bring interaction between different peoples and visiting cities? Well, Philip and I were reflecting on this earlier today. What is it that we've actually learnt? Well, one of the things that we've learnt is the enormous convening power of a university, albeit with the support of the Alfred Herrhausen Society, which has allowed us to do that. And that's not a simple statement, the fact that you can actually bring together in a sort of nearly neutral platform peoples in different cities who want to actually talk to each other about things which are sometimes very difficult. And in that sense, you could say that the urban age itself as a sort of mechanism is not unlike cities. It's about the flows of people, it's about the flows of ideas, and even this thing has a life of its own. But anyway, I'm trying to control it, but I can't. It's very much about these sort of different dynamics which actually bring cities together. And probably because we're a university, because we realize that there's a sort of skills gap out there in terms of who decides what happens in cities, we're also very interested in effectively educating new generations of city makers across the board. I mean, if I think, what have we actually found? Well, we found that design actually really does matter in cities. You can actually make cities humanize people and city dwellers or brutalize them by the way they're actually designed. Just think of what it means to commute for 4 or 5 hours in São Paulo, Mexico City, as opposed to, say, Hong Kong, where the average commuting time is 20 minutes. Think of the cities of walls, of barbed wire that you find in enclaves in African cities or some Asian cities or Latin American cities in particular. And think of the luck we have in London of actually not actually being confronted by ghettos of necessary rich or poor, even though, of course, we have a massive housing crisis facing us today. We've also discovered that, of course, governance, without getting governance right, you really can't do many of the things that we've been talking about even up until now, and we will in a moment. There are deep divisions between national governments, federal governments, state governments, and people who make decisions in cities. So those are some of the thoughts, some of the ideas, which will cut across everything we're going to be talking about in the next 10 days or so. Now, in a moment, I'll hand over to Tessa, who really is running the talk tonight, chairing the event. Tessa, I think, is well known to many Londoners as the mayor we should have had but won't have, and, of course, has been a Member of Parliament for a number of years, minister in several Labour governments, and now, much, much more importantly than any of that, Tessa, you're a visiting professor here at the, in practice here at the LSE. One last thing I want to talk about is not only have we decided with the Alfred Herr Housing Society to celebrate with these lectures, but also to take all that information that we've assembled, all the analysis, all the essays, all the narratives, all the discussions, all the videos of the conferences, and put them onto a new website. And right now, I'm launching it to the world. This is the first time that all of you will be aware of it. It's actually a test website. It's not the definitive one. There will be sort of things that don't work, and we'd love you to test it out and let us know what you think. But you will find for the first time that you can compare a density map of New Delhi and London, or you can find an essay by Richard Sennett or Saskia Sassen, if you want. So please note the website, and also in a moment note the hashtag, which will be there, which we'd obviously like you to use, not for just those of you who are in the room, but those of you who are listening to this live stream around the world. Let me just end by doing the most important thing for anyone like me happening to stand here tonight and welcoming you and sort of presenting this celebration of 10 years of work. There literally are hundreds of people one would want to thank, but I won't. I'm going to start with just thanking those who've been responsible for making this event and the next events happen, led by Emily Cruz, so thank you very much. I want to thank Mike Hurd and Guardian Cities, who, as you've noticed already, has been publishing in Guardian Cities a number of the important articles and presentations which are being made this week. Obviously, the two founding sort of figures in many ways who made it happen, both intellectually and logistically, Richard Sennett, my colleague here, and Wolfgang Novak, who was then the director of the Alfred Herrhausen Society. It wouldn't have happened without them and got the ball rolling. But really, obviously, the two key people I have to thank are Philip Rode and Ute Wieland for actually making it all happen. So we now look forward to the next 10 years. Tessa, the floor is yours. Thank you very much for coming.
Okay, wonderful. I'm going to be very brief indeed, and obviously joining Ricky in his welcome of you all. And I think the evidence of all you here this evening and how quickly this session sold out is evidence that this is an issue which raises so many questions. questions that are difficult but are compelling and are urgent. So I'm going to introduce the first of our speakers this evening to open up our discussion on whether cities can be the solution to the challenge of climate change by inviting Professor Nicholas Stern, the Professor of Economics at the Grantham Institute of the Economics of Climate Change, one of the great pioneers of policy development and sort of intellectual marshalling of the argument and the threat of climate change. And Nick is going to focus very particularly on the economics and the politics of incorporating climate change in the way cities work. So, Nick, let us hear what you have to say.
I think this is fun. Let's try not to use that.
Ricky, Tessa, thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction. Ricky, for the introduction to the whole thing. And happy birthday. And it's very nice of you to invite us to celebrate with you. And we should be celebrating because what Urban Age has done is been of great creativity and importance. Now, first thing, can you hear me in the back row? Yeah, very good. Right. There's some movement. What I want to do is to come at this as an economist who has spent his whole life working on public policy and economic development. And that's the way I got into this problem, because climate change is all about development and it does need a great deal of public policy. It doesn't get solved by itself. And over the last years, I've become more and more interested, because the data scream at us that it's cities that are the huge drivers of all this. I've become more and more interested in cities. So what you do at the London School of Economics, if you get interested in something, you go and find one of your colleagues who, or some of your colleagues, who know about things you don't know about. That's why you're at a university, and that's why, in particular, you're at the LSE. So thank you again to colleagues in cities who have taught me so much. And I should also, in doing this, recognize Dimitri Zengelis. I don't know if Dimitri is here. There he is. Glad. Thank you for making it on time, Dimitri. But Dimitri and I collaborated on these issues over quite a long period. So what I want to do is to talk about these three things you see in front of us. Before we dive into the city's story, and of course the detail matters enormously, let's just remind ourselves about the stakes that we're playing for. And that's where I wanted to begin. That's just a couple of slides or so on why this thing matters so much and why we have to move quickly. And I'll say then the bulk of what I have to say will be about cities. But last of all, I'm deeply involved in the story of Paris. I'm an ami du cher for Laurent Fabius, who is chairing the COP and on the Strategic Advisory Committee for Christiana Figueres, who is the Executive Secretary of the UNFCCC. So I'm directly involved, unpaid and unsupported, I should say, in those tasks. But I'll just at the end give a couple of minutes on where I see Paris going. So essentially, we should start by recognizing that these next two decades are absolutely critical. They're two decades which will determine essentially the shape of what happens this century, and indeed to the future of the relationship between human beings and the planet. Two reasons for that. One is that we're right on the edge, with about 400 parts per million of CO2, nearly 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent. We're right on the edge of being possible to hold to 2 degrees. And holding to 2 degrees really does matter. Beyond that, it's dangerous. There are dangers of essentially irreversible events, self-reinforcing events, runaway events, for example, the thawing of the permafrost and the release of methane. So it's not for nothing that we think of 2 degrees as a borderline. Dangerous, and lots of nasty things happen before you get to 2 degrees. But basically, we're at the edge in terms of concentrations of greenhouse gases of being able to hold to 2 degrees. We still can, and it's, of course, a vital in that story to look after our forests, look after our soils, which can become much better stores of carbon, and our oceans and biosystems. That's all part of the story, but we will determine probably in the next 2 decades just how well we're going to do on those fronts. It's an extraordinary responsibility that we have. We're actually lucky to be alive because there are so many exciting things that we can do, but there is a grave responsibility. There's a second, let me talk about the scale of the risks and then emphasize the second reason why it's so important, and that is around cities and what's happening to them. But I've said we're on the borderline of being able to hold to 2 degrees, but why are the risks of these 3, 4, 5 degrees so big? Well, first we should recognize that we grew up as civilizations with the cultivation of grasses into grains. You sit and wait then for the grain to grow, so you become stable, you have a surplus, so you can have universities and this architects and that sort of thing. And that is a society which grew since the end of the last ice age. It's 8,000 or 9,000 years old, and in that period the temperature range has been plus or minus one. The baseline is we usually take is the 19th century, before the fossil fuel powered industrial revolution really took off. We've grown up, our civilizations have become what they've come in a very narrow range. We are already just about 1 degree C this year, 0.9 degrees if you average a bit over recent years. We're already on the edge of that very benign period. We are, as we're almost certain to do, to get close to 2 degrees, we're already moving substantially beyond that climate. 3 degrees we have not seen on this planet for 3 million years or so. We've been around as Homo sapiens maybe a quarter of a million years. And as I emphasized, we really grew up as civilizations in the last 8,000 years or so. We are into uncharted territory. We're starting that now. 2 degrees will be deep into that, and 3 degrees would likely transform. Desertification, much of southern Europe would look like the Sahara Desert. Inundation as land-based ice sheets melt and sea levels could rise very rapidly. So it's very important to be aware of the stakes we're playing for, because a lot of the things we're going to talk about today take time. So we have to begin by recognizing we're in a hurry. We've got to make big investments. We've got to make big investments quickly. But we've also got to recognize that those are incredibly productive, attractive investments, and that's much of what we'll be talking about today. The kind of changes we're talking about would lead probably hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of people to move, because they'd rewrite where you could live and how you could live. So I won't go on about that much more, but very strong underlining at the beginning of the stakes we're going to be playing for. Now, where are we in relation to Paris? Well, the Paris promises, they're called intended nationally determined contributions, come in around 55 billion tons of CO2 equivalent or so as flows of emissions in the year 2030. We're about 50 now. So it looks as though, if you look at the contributions stated for Paris, there are about 160 countries covering about 90% of emissions that have made those set out those intentions. We're talking about a rise of about 10% in emissions over the next 15 years. A 2-degree path would really need about a 20% fall down to near 40. So we're going to go on a difficult path, from the point of view of holding to 2 degrees, that is, for another 15 years or so. That will mean that we have to take still stronger action than we might have had to take had we moved earlier. A path which recognises where we're going on the way to 2030 will need zero total emissions by the end of the century. That's not a political statement. That is looking at the amount of emissions we can make and still stay close to 2 degrees, because it's the sum total over time that matters, not just the flow in any particular year. Looking at the sum total that we have left over if we're to hold to 2 degrees, and looking at the next 15 years, asking where we're going. And then if you do that, you can work out pretty directly that you need zero total emissions by the end of the century. So that's the kind of planning we should make for. And in order to do that, it's likely that we're going to have to go close to zero emissions from electricity around mid-century, because so much of the rest of it is likely to be driven off electricity. And remember that we now have enough proven reserves of coal, gas and oil so that we can only burn about half of them uncaptured and stay within 2 degrees. Again, that's the physics and the arithmetic, looking at how much space we've got left if we are to have a reasonable chance of holding to 2 degrees. So I've tried to do very quickly where we are in terms of concentrations, what risks we're playing for, and the radicalness of the action that we're going to need to hold for 2 degrees. So we've got a big problem. But the fun part of the story is that when you look at what you have to do, it becomes enormously attractive. You can really create cities and societies that matter. So let me say something about the story. And this is really the second reason why we have to act very quickly. We're around half of the world's population in cities now, slightly over, and that means there's a bit over 3.5 billion people in urban areas. We'll probably be ballpark 70% of a population over 9 billion people in cities by mid-century. That will be roughly 6.5 billion people. So 3 billion people are going to come in the next 35 years. It doesn't matter much whether it's 2.8 or 3.3. It's a very large increase relative to the 3.5 billion or so we have now. That happens only once in human history. After you've moved from 50 to 70%, it slows down in terms of the fraction in urban areas. We can see from the demography that the population increase will probably slow down in the middle of this century too. So we are dealing with, over the next 35 years, a unique event in human history with our cities close to doubling, and it won't happen again. But how we manage that is absolutely critical. We can manage it in a way that's very bad and that we stay with congested, polluted, unproductive, unattractive cities, or we can manage it very differently. So that's the second reason, for that 35 years, what we do in the next 2 decades really matters. So from the point of view of the level of concentrations and from the point of view of the growth that's coming in the size of cities, this next 2 decades is absolutely vital. I don't think that is well enough understood, that this is a special period of responsibility. Those who lead, those who analyze, those who propose have to think about changing things rapidly and making this next 20 years the beginnings of something very different. Well, cities are well placed because of the things I've described, the problems I've described. There are exciting returns to changing those things. You can make them much less congested, much less polluted, much less noisy, and we can see much of what is necessary to do that. Innovation will be a big part of the story. I know Bruce Katz will be saying something about that. And this is a wonderful moment because you've got very low interest rates, likely to stay that way for a while yet, and extraordinary technical progress in digitals, materials, and biotechs. Big problems, big opportunities for growth, low interest rates, fastest technological progress the world has ever seen. This, if that's not a description of a mammoth opportunity, I don't know what is. So we have to think very hard about how to make that happen. Cities are very attractive
places to bring and create ideas. They've got together because of the productivity of getting together in terms of efficiency. They become very dynamic places. The best cities attract the best of talents, and they can get their own dynamic processes of politics going. Once you start creating facilities for pedestrians and cyclists, you create a constituency of pedestrians and cyclists, and they can be forces for further change. The cyclists are, as many of you know, are one of the most powerful political forces in Copenhagen. Anybody tries to do anything to monkey around with the cyclists will have a big political problem. They create their own dynamics, dynamics for change. So great returns to cities, cities wonderful places for ideas. But we also know, and we have to be realistic about these things, that cities can go wrong. But they can also be places where innovation and social action happens. Getting a country together down one path can be very difficult. Getting a city together with a sense of community to go down a path can be, and has indeed happened. But we also know that cities can get mired in corruption and difficulty. And the way in which we think about institutions, the way in which we think particularly about the institutions of public finance, which is a big part of my research over the years, will be very important. But we shouldn't underestimate the political difficulties of change. I mean, Robert Putnam's study of Italian cities over the years showed very big differences between cities in terms of creativity, corruption, and so on, but also that these things were very difficult to change because those characteristics carried on over a long period of time. But they can change, and I'm sure we're going to get examples of how they do change. One note on public finances, absolutely at the heart of all this. I've been living and working in India for more than 40 years and China for more than 25, and the way in which you see in those cases and around the world, the way in which the public finances function are enormously important. And one of the reasons you've got such big urban sprawl in China is that the local public finance system is underdeveloped and much of the funding comes from selling land. So if you want to get funding for local development, you sell land on the fringes. The public finance story is very profound because urban sprawl in particular is so important to our problems. The story of design, that there are people in this room who know much more about the story of design than I do, but we did some work in the Better Growth, Better Climate report, which I co-chaired with Felipe Calderon, and Dimitri and Philip and others worked very much on that, underlining the importance of compactness and avoidance of sprawl. And I've already indicated the dangers of public finance in creating sprawl, but that is, I hope, something that we'll come back to. One example we gave in Better Growth, Better Climate was the difference between Atlanta and Barcelona. Much the same income per capita, much the same population, but Atlanta uses 6 or 7 times more emissions than Barcelona, for the obvious reason that you drive around in Atlanta much more. And hands up, anybody here from Atlanta, by the way? All right, well, I'll go forward. How many of you would rather live in Barcelona than Atlanta? Huh? These things matter, so we have to think about, and these things are going to be built right around the world, so we have to think very hard about how they're going to work. Now, before I say something about Paris, let me just underline one thing, because this is changing the politics of climate change. We have begun to understand in the last 4 or 5 years the huge cost of air pollution around the world. It's been the last 4 or 5 years because we can see now much better through satellite observation where PM2.5, where the other major particulates are in the world. The China has woken up to this very strongly. It's been a big part of the changes which it is making. A recent Berkeley Earth paper found that breathing in many of Chinese cities is like smoking 40 cigarettes a day. 13 of the top 20 most polluted cities are in India. Only one of the top 50 is in China. We keep talking about China. It's much worse elsewhere. And we know it's very bad in London too. 30,000 Supreme Court about 4 months ago accepted a study. UK Supreme Court accepted a study which said that 29,000 people die a year from air pollution in the UK, perhaps 10,000 of them in London. 1,700 people killed in the UK from road accidents, 15 times more from air pollution. If the Evening Standard quite rightly makes a great deal of a cyclist being crushed under a lorry, it's terrible. But so too is the many people whose lives are cut short by air pollution. It is a huge problem, and millions die each year around the world, and a big part of it is caused by transport and particularly by coal in various ways. So this is something that's now beginning to change that politics, and I think it's enormously important to understand it. I grew up in a London which was really foggy. I had to walk home from school, 3 miles sometimes, when they took the buses off the road because you couldn't see. And we acted very quickly, actually, and switched to smokeless fuel. Sometimes the politics can change very quickly. The congestion charge came into London. Everybody said it's hopeless, it's never going to happen. And actually it happened very quickly. So if we can help deepen the understanding, not only of how big the problems are, but also that there's so much we can do to handle them. Let me finish with saying something about Paris. The French presidency has their Paris Alliance for Climate Action. They've got four pillars. The first of them is the legal text. The legal text will describe how you measure, how you share what you've measured. It will describe how we get together to revise the pledges or the promises that people have made for 2030. That will be the text of the agreement. And that will be binding. It will be an agreement. It will be called an international agreement because you can't call it an international treaty or international protocol, because if you do, it has to go to the US Senate. Nobody wants to go to the US Senate. But it will be an international agreement, and President Obama will be able to sign it because of that. That'll be the formal thing. The other three, though, are very important also, although they are not binding agreements in any sense. I've already spoken about the numbers. Each country has, over 160 countries have put in their numbers of where they plan to be in 2030 and given policies that could guide them. They are important, and I think we should take them seriously. Most of the numbers that were put in around Copenhagen and Cancun in terms of where people plan to be for 2020, look like being met. So even though there's not a formal binding treaty policed by police from Mars and judged by judges from Venus, that is not there. And you wouldn't expect it to be there, you wouldn't expect it to work. But these things do matter, and they are being considered, and policies have come, so it's right to take them very seriously. I haven't got time to talk about finance. That matters. That's the third pillar. But the action agenda is particularly relevant today. These are countries coming together not countries coming together. They're cities coming together. They're businesses coming together, NGOs. Innovation will be a very big part of that. President Obama and Prime Minister Modi and Bill Gates will make an announcement on November the 30th about how they'll go forward with innovation. So that's the first part of the story, to understand what it is that they're doing. They're trying to create a Paris alliance with those four pillars. Now, why is Paris not Copenhagen? How many people were at Copenhagen? No, there are at least a handful of people there. Where it was cold and it was chaotic and it was quarrelsome, but it did produce the Copenhagen Accord, which became the agreement a year later in Cancun. But the politics was very, very difficult. It was still very divided into rich countries and poor countries. It's still divided, but nowhere like to the extent, and the pledges have come in on an equal basis, no distinction between rich countries and poor countries. The preparation has been much better, and it was very well. The text process began last year in Lima, very well organized by the Peruvians. The presidents, prime ministers, and indeed princes will come at the beginning, not at the end. They will say to their people, you get on with it, we want an agreement. Don't come back without an agreement. The chaos of Copenhagen had many dimensions, but one dimension of the chaos at Copenhagen is that they had all the people at the end, and they thought all their people would have done their job, and then they just had to sign. Well, they ended up trying to negotiate themselves in a small room, and that is not the way they're going to go. There'll be some grandstanding in the last weeks and days. It's happening now because you have to go for unanimity, so you're going to get a few holdouts at the end. So don't be surprised by that. But the basic test of success is not the level of the promises for 2030. I've already discussed that, and I've already said that they're much better than business as usual, but they're not nearly what we need for 2 degrees. What the test of success is, whether we regard this as a turning point and whether there are sound reasons for believing there's going to be acceleration from there. I do think it's a turning point, and we have to look at what comes to see whether there are sound reasons for thinking there might be an acceleration. But our job as academics, as policy advisors, as politicians, whatever it is, journalists, whatever it is that you are, our job is try to see how we can contribute to that acceleration, because that's what we need in the road from Paris. But that also is what I think, with cities at the centre of it all, what is supremely possible and enormously attractive. Thank you very much.
And setting out some of the unavoidable and scary questions that we cities have to answer, and for underlining how much is resting on agreement and a new global framework in Paris. Can we move on to our next distinguished speaker, Professor Karen Seto, Professor of Geography at Yale University, who's also a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And what Karen is going to look at particularly in the context of cities tackling climate change is land use, spatial planning, and infrastructure. Karen, thank you.
Well, first, I want to thank Ricky and Philip for the invitation to participate in another Urban Age event. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to the conversation. So Nick has really set up the stage very nicely. Thank you very much for the remarks that I'm going to make in the next 15 minutes or so. And the answer to this question that I've put up here is a pretty simple yes. And what I'd like to do is actually go through some of the ways in which cities can mitigate climate change, and again, underlie the urgency of this, what we really need to do. I want to start off with this statistic that came out of the last IPCC report, the fifth assessment report, the AR5. And one of the big conclusions of the third working group, which I was a part of, is that greenhouse gas emissions growth continues to accelerate. The growth continues to accelerate despite mitigation efforts in many parts of the world. I'm in an environment school at Yale, and when this result came out, I will say that it was quite disconcerting because there are many efforts underway. We would like to think that these mitigation efforts are making an impact. Why do we see the emissions growth accelerating despite these mitigation efforts? We see that over the last 10 years, or from 2000 to 2010, the growth in emissions was even greater than in the period before. Here you see that from the period of 1970 to 2000, the rate of growth per year was about 1.3%, and in contrast, from 2000 to 2010, that rate of growth was 2.2% per year. And the economic collapse, you see there's a little blip there, but didn't really make that much of an impact in changing the overall trend. And you see in this graph in the yellow that the dominant driver of these emissions is fossil fuel and industrial processes. Now, I want to just spend a couple of minutes talking about the changes over the last 40 years in the geography of emissions, because it's going to be really important when we get into the discussion about urbanization. What we're seeing is that there's been a significant shift globally in the geographic patterns of greenhouse gas emissions. From 2000 to 2010, these upper middle-income countries, and these are the World Bank designation, not the IPCC designation, but if you look at the World Bank designation, I'll give you a list of these countries. These countries were responsible for 75% of the increase in total annual greenhouse gas emissions. So you can see that total emissions per year, this doesn't work, barely works, but you can see it's 18.3 gigatons, almost catches up to the very high income levels. Now, I will say that this is a little bit misleading, because if you look at the list of countries, it's like, you know, when you take introduction to statistics and the teacher says, you know, in some cases you might use the average, in other cases you don't want to use the average, because if you have someone like Bill Gates as part of your sample, your average may be skewed. And so these numbers are clearly skewed for the middle, the upper middle income numbers by one or two countries that have very high emission rates. But the other thing to notice is that when countries at the lower middle income and upper middle income, we see that industry and energy are a very large percentage of their total greenhouse gas profile. But for high income countries, we see that transport, you know, it's those cars that we like, transport becomes a growing portion of the overall profile. So I want to just have you keep that in mind in terms of this changing geography, what happens to emissions as countries develop from lower income, upper middle income to high income countries. I want to just put this statistic up here because it's probably something that many of you are not familiar with, that if the top 50 emitting cities were a single country, it would rank third in emissions behind China and the United States. So this really underscores the, I would say, the currency that cities have in affecting climate change. That what happens in these 50 countries, or 50 cities, certainly has a really big impact. Now, I'm curious to know how many people here have read the fourth assessment report of the IPCC. Okay, you're really dating yourselves now. So like there are five people in the room who read the fourth assessment report. So all the previous assessment reports of the IPCC, up until the most recent one that was published last year, those assessment reports looked at mitigation primarily through a sectoral lens: energy, buildings, transport. And for those of us who are urbanists in the room, it was very clear that there needed to be a chapter on cities and how cities could mitigate climate change. But it wasn't until the most recent assessment report that the IPCC did include a brand new chapter on how cities, and especially spatial planning and infrastructure, can mitigate climate change. And this entire chapter, all 100 plus pages, you can download from the IPCC website. I do want to just say very quickly that inclusion of this chapter in the IPCC was not without controversy, because the IPCC, the constituents, the clients of the IPCC are nation states. They're not cities. So when many of us said, you know, there needs to be a chapter on cities and how cities can mitigate climate change, this is one of the biggest trends of the 21st century. It's climate change and it's urbanization. And if we don't have a chapter on climate change, we're missing this mega trend. And we can talk offline and maybe during the discussion about the politics of the local versus the national, and I'm sure there are many other people in this room more competent than I to talk about this, but clearly this played out in including a chapter on cities. So I want to highlight a couple of the main take-home messages from this chapter. And one of the take-home messages Nick already alluded to or mentioned is that cities account for the majority of fossil fuel-based carbon emissions. However, there's a lot of variation between cities And there's a lot of variation between countries. When we assessed the literature, what we found was that there are basically four drivers of urban emissions. And these four drivers are pretty straightforward. It's the economy. It's the socioeconomic structure of these cities. So if you're a manufacturing city, if you're an export city versus if you're a services city or an import city, you'll have very different emissions profiles. In terms of your socioeconomics, it depends on the age cohort of your city, the age structure, the household size, income levels. But the third thing that matters is also the technology. What types of technologies does your city use? Technology in terms of heating and cooling, in terms of your building. And so the vintage of your buildings has a very big impact on your total emissions profile. And then last but not least, the urban form, the form and structure, the density, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a moment, but the form of a city has a big impact. And all four of these interact together, so it's very difficult to parse out one from another. But what you see here are these differences played out at the global level. So what you see here on the left are Annex 1 cities, and on the right are non-Annex 1 cities. And in blue, these are cities where the energy use, the per capita energy use, is lower than the national average. So in blue, basically, you're a city where your energy use is lower than the national average. And in yellow, these are cities where energy use is higher than the national average. And if you take those four factors, those four main drivers of urban emissions that I just talked about, you can kind of start to understand why we see these differences. So in some cases, especially for the non-Annex 1 countries, these are cities that are primarily manufacturing cities. They're export cities. They're producing stuff. On the other hand, on these Annex 1 cities, these are cities that are service cities. They're service economies. Some of these are cities that have higher density, higher accessibility, more co-location of work with residences, and also much more efficient technology. And so it's these four factors that are playing out. But I think it's really important for us to remember that there are significant differences between cities, and that is a really critical thing to think about when we think about when we start talking about policies. I will underscore this window of opportunity, though, this window of opportunity to shape the environment and to shape not only the urban environment but really the global environment. Nick has already mentioned that, okay, we're at a little bit more than 50% of the global population living in urban areas. What does that translate into in terms of land use change, in terms of the built environment we need to support people? We did a study a few years ago, and we found that every day for the first 30 years of this century, every day, about 20,000 American football fields becomes urban. And I'm sorry, I don't know how big an American football field is relative to a football field is. But someone will quickly do the calculation. But it's quite a large area every single day for the first 30 years. Every 10 days, about 1.3 million people move into cities. So this is something that's happening now. It's not something that's happening in the future. But for cities to be part of the solution, the climate change solution, one of the things that they absolutely must do is reverse the trend of declining densities. And this is a graphic that's taken from the Fifth Assessment Report, which is based on the work of Solly Angel and his colleagues. But basically what he and his colleagues, and this has been corroborated by many other studies, shows that across income levels, across geographies, we see that cities around the world are declining in terms of their densities. So we're not becoming more compact and walkable. We're actually sprawling out and becoming more of transit-based, car-based cities. So if cities are going to be part of the solution, this trend has to be reversed. Now, I'm not going to have time to go into this in detail, but I do want to say that urban form, and I've mentioned these four factors that drive urban emissions, urban form is one of the factors, one of the main factors that localities can affect completely within their jurisdiction. whether it's through zoning or land use laws. Four characteristics of urban form are especially important for shaping urban emissions. One of them is density. But density, as we'll get to now, is that increasing density alone is not sufficient for reducing urban emissions. Because these urban form, these factors, there are a number of them. It's not just density, it's also land use. Places that have a higher land use mix tend to have lower emissions. Places that have high connectivity, where you have a lot of intersection density, basically makes it easier for people to walk to places. Those are also places that have lower emissions. But then really the one thing that has a big, big impact is this last point here, which is accessibility. And accessibility in the literature can be measured a number of different ways, but think of it simply as how easy is it for you to get to the services and activities that you're interested in, whether it's school or work or your grocery store. How easy is it to get to? Now we can think of ease or things to be places that are accessible a number of ways. You can think of a freeway going really fast on in a fast car as being very accessible. But then those are places that generally aren't very connected and don't have a lot of high land use mix. You can think of accessibility where residences are co-located or located very close to where people work. And that is probably one of the most defining, ambitious characteristics in terms of low carbon urban form is for places to have high accessibility. But I think one of the important things to remember is that density alone is not going to solve our climate problem. Increasing density without intentionally locating people close to jobs and close to services will not lower emissions. One of the things that we're going to see coming in the next, it's happening now, but really over the next 10, 20 years, is infrastructure development, primarily in lower income and developing country cities. And this infrastructure development is going to result in significant emissions to mine the material, to process the material, to transport the material, and to build the buildings. You know, oftentimes when we think about climate change and policies to mitigate climate change, we focus on things like energy efficiency, of the lights, of our buildings, of our windows, of our cars. But there's an embodied energy, embodied emissions associated with building all this stuff. And so this is another graphic that's taken from the IPCC report, which shows differences in infrastructure between Annex I countries. You can see the average here for Annex I countries. We have a lot of infrastructure in our countries compared to the global average down here, which is relatively low. If developing countries over the next 20 years develop their infrastructure in the same way that we have in Annex I countries, this is what the emissions profiles will look like. This is just to build the infrastructure. This is not to operate the infrastructure. So there's a lot of emissions associated with building the infrastructure to support the urban population of tomorrow, even of today. What we're seeing with satellite data, you know, we keep thinking that urbanization, this urban transition and urban revolution is something that's going to happen in the future, but it's already happening now. This is work that we've done with some collaborators at University of New Hampshire, where they've used satellite data to look at the growth of infrastructure. And what's interesting here is this is data from 1999 to 2009, and I'm going to give you a crash course in satellite image analysis. So what we have here are two different types of satellite data. On the x-axis, these are the night lights. How many people here have seen the night lights? A lot more than people, those who've read the fourth assessment report. So this is the night lights that you see in the Earth from space at night over a 10-year period. And so this arrow, the arrows that move in the horizontal direction basically show how much additional light is there. So this is growth of infrastructure, but also growth in the horizontal direction. And then in the Y direction, this is a different a satellite. It's a radar scatterometer. It basically is able to characterize the physical structure, the height of the urban area. So what we see in these four Indian cities is Bangalore, Hyderabad, Chennai, and Delhi. They've grown out, but not very up. Okay. So those of you who've worked or been to India, this is no surprise. African cities, we see a very similar trend. There's a little bit of growing up here in Luanda, a little bit in Lagos, but by and large, these cities are growing out. But this represents real infrastructure development on the ground. And then we get to Chinese cities, where we see significant vertical infrastructure development. This is concrete, this is steel. These are embodied carbon emissions. So this lock-in, this infrastructure and carbon lock-in is something that's happening now. It's not something that we have to stop for the future. We have to think about how we change the patterns today. I will end with this positive note, because I am ultimately an optimist, which is that there is an urgency. There is this window of opportunity, because once infrastructure is built, it's very difficult to change it. And once you build the backbones of a city, the roads, the transport lines, et cetera, it's very difficult to change it. And so there is this urgency, this window of opportunity. But more urban areas will be built in the first three decades of this century than all of human history. So those of you who are planners and designers, you have your work set out for you. So with that, thank you very much.
How wonderful. And my goodness me, what a challenge has been laid bare. But let's remember the importance of optimism and a sense of empowerment that solutions are available. Now, we're moving on very, very swiftly to our panel discussion. And we have Bruce Katz, who's the Vice President of the Brookings Institute, and Philip Rode, who is Executive Director of the Cities Programme here at LSE. And we're going to begin this part of the session by inviting, first of all, Bruce to comment and react, and then Philip. And then, in the time that we have available, after these, our panelists have had a decent exchange and argument with each other, we'll take questions. There's not going to be a huge amount of time, but we'll do our best. Right, now.
From here or from?
Wherever you're most comfortable.
So first of all, thanks for having me. I want to say happy birthday to the Urban Edge.
Yes.
I would sing it, but then people would flee for the exits. It is really important to understand the impact that this effort has had on urban research, on urban language, on urban policy, on urban practice. And so Uta, this is about the highest ROI that any philanthropy has on anything. So congratulations for that. Really sobering presentations. And in theory, what we would need to do in a country like the United States, so I'll just speak from an American perspective, is you would have a national government take the leadership role in setting the platform for radical reductions in carbon emissions.
Exactly.
You would set a price on carbon. You would invest at scale in clean energy research and development. You would basically send signals through tax, through spending, and housing and infrastructure, through the multiple dimensions of a society to go down a different path. And, I mean, the reality, as everyone in this room knows, despite President Obama's best intentions, there essentially is no national government in the United States today. It is mired in partisan gridlock. And essentially, it has sent a signal to the United States, to the society, we are basically not acting. And so the rest of y'all, cities and metropolitan areas in particular, you're in charge. And so what essentially is happening, because states, for the most part, are also on a frolic and detour, with the exception of California and maybe a few others, cities and metropolitan areas are essentially being forced to step up, not just as city governments, but as networks of public, private, civic, university, labor, community leaders, and to take the hard actions necessary to the extent that they can to make a difference. So there are three kinds of actions happening in the land of climate denial right now that I think are important to focus on. The first, our cities are beginning to invest in a new kind of built environment. So what are we talking about? And Karen had a great slide up there about the various ways of looking at this. Sustainable transit infrastructure matched with new land use and zoning. So this is Los Angeles, this is Denver, basically going to voters to basically raise their sales tax, to raise tens of billions of dollars over multiple decades, to build large state-of-the-art transit systems that then begin to alter development patterns. Now, in the past, some of those investments were made by our national government. Now, essentially, cities are having to go to their own citizens and say, well, they're gone, it's up to us. Other cities, Washington, D.C., investing in a new kind of clean water infrastructure. Cities like Philadelphia basically investing in new core city infrastructure in the downtown and midtown so that they can grow 10x residential, 5x jobs around Drexel, University of Pennsylvania, essentially the core of the city. So what we're seeing first and foremost are cities using their own financing or going to voters for new revenues or going essentially aggregating public, private, and civic capital to do what we all know has to be done, right? More choice in transportation, more density and accessibility, all the things that Karen was talking about, but have to be done through local resources, essentially, or local action that connects to institutional investors. Second piece, what do cities do? They set rules. They set building codes. They set zoning and land use ordinances. They have mandates on reporting on emissions. And so that's the second thing that cities are beginning to do. Now, Portland, Oregon has been doing this for decades. They drew an urban growth boundary back in the 1970s. And no surprise, where has most of the growth gone in Portland, Oregon? We don't compare Atlanta to Barcelona. We compare Atlanta to Portland. because Americans generally don't have a passport, but that's okay. So not surprisingly, there's been a large amount of reinvestment in Portland, Oregon. And because of that reinvestment and because of the sort of tilting of growth and development to the core, you've got the benefits of density that enable you to build out streetcars, build out public transit, build out the kind of radical mixed use that increasingly not just a new demographics, but a new kind of open innovative economy want. Boston has done this on energy efficiency. Other cities have done it on a range of other signals to the market. Last bit, and this really may be the greatest contribution of the United States to deal with climate change in the absence of any national leadership, which frankly I think won't be coming for quite some time. So you all watched the 2016 election. You must be horrified by the reality show that is going on in the United States. You know, buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride, right? So what we will contribute to climate change solutions will be out of our innovative sector. And that's because the United States still, through our advanced research institutions, through our military, and through our national labs, has an incredible depth of basic science, which then leads to the commercialization of ideas, the startup of companies, the maturing of companies, that essentially create the new kinds of products and services to help us mitigate climate and carbon emissions at scale. Now, is this going to solve the problem? Obviously not. But if you go to Atlanta, which, again, is the poster child for sprawl, there is Georgia Tech. If you go to Pittsburgh, which is sprawl in a no-growth kind of metropolis, there is Carnegie Mellon. If you go to Boston, there is MIT. And these are the places around which now are congregating entrepreneurs and startups and global companies with their own R&D and investors and venture and a large segment network of researchers that basically get up every morning and say, how do we, through market innovation, you know, the creation of a product that can be then introduced in a Beijing or a Mumbai, or a service that then can be applied, how can we contribute to climate change solutions? So I think at the end of the day, what cities do, and the urban age really is at the vanguard of basically showing this. One city innovates, it creates a new norm of how to invest, of how to solve problems, and you know, this goes from relatively, in the scheme of things, simple things like bike lanes to much more complicated large infrastructure solutions. But new norms are established that then get basically spread horizontally across the world. And again, cities are centers of innovation, centers of economy that are increasingly the places in which the new products and services will be invented to be applied. So the United States, from an outside perspective, again, must be semi-horrifying, or maybe it's just completely horrifying. But our cities and our metropolitan areas are stepping up to deal with climate change, and they are inventing, I think, what essentially will be new norms that will be replicated across the world.
Great, Bruce. Thank you very much indeed. Philip.
Thank you, Tessa. Let me try to bring all of this back to the Urban Age program. And what we've just heard from Nick and Karen is how climate policy has embraced the urban dimension. And I want to reflect a bit how urbanism has engaged with climate, using our last 10 years as sort of a reflection point. And I can see two main arguments that can be made. The first one is, and given the particular urgency we have just seen, that we have probably not been engaging as urbanists with this subject enough. And there are a couple of reasons which I want to speculate on why that is the case. First, there's the technical language of climate change mitigation and adaptation, which tends to disguise the deeply political nature of climate action in cities.
Yeah,
I'll come back to this in a moment. There are very strong associations, particularly in some circles, and these circles are big in the urban world, where we see that climate policy directly sort of in sync with technocratic, top-down government intervention, which not only assumes that efficient governments exist everywhere, but also is at odds with more cooperative forms, post-modern notions of urban governance. And then there's the radical change required to achieve the 2-degree sort of global warming target, which directly leads us to a tension between what you could refer to as an urban evolutionary process and a revolution. Think of strict building and land use regulations, which will probably have to severely limit suburbanization, conventional car use, and the use of unsustainable building materials, the main point which Karen was making. So as a result, and reflecting on our urban age conversations and the cities we have been working in, climate action has remained kind of disconnected from particularly daily urban practice we have been discussing, from more ordinary city perspectives, issues around urban inequality, poverty, and the right to the city. Take one example which we have been exposed to when we were working in South Africa. Post-apartheid housing policy in South Africa, which for very obvious and culturally sensitive reasons was promoting the ownership and therefore the further proliferation of very low-density bungalows at the urban periphery. Now, the environmental damage of this policy is fairly obvious and it's enormous. But if we come with our climate change debate to the discussion, we really need to understand the politics of the urban expansion that is playing out. Now, from a completely different perspective, and I'm turning now the view, it's absolutely clear that city-level sustainability thinking, which actually is maybe even more mature than national-level sustainability thinking, and the pushing of the urban sustainability community have led to an entirely new recognition of the role of cities at the national and international level. Karen mentioned that we shouldn't take it for granted that the IPCC chapter has, in some ways, a chapter on cities, although they are not allowed to call it cities. It's the human settlements. Take the most recent urban SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. We can't take these things for granted. They were established for the first time. It was a battle. Now, as part of the urban age, there were actually very few issues that we discussed over the last 10 years that didn't have a central and direct link with the underlying arguments that connect cities and climate change. In some ways, urban climate action is simply common sense urban development. Let me give you a few examples of how good urbanism equals a better climate. Richard Sennett's elaboration on the universal importance of fine-grained, mixed, and intensely interconnected urban development is one example. But there was also our colleague, the Indian urbanist Geetam Tiwari, who constantly emphasized the importance of enabling the most equitable means of travel for social reasons, and that is walking. And the late Indian transport expert Fabio Casaroli, who worked a lot and informed us on the importance of efficient and affordable public transport. It's exactly these co-benefits, these mutual benefits, which we really need to, I think, centrally regard as our notion of hope. Three final examples. Compact, connected, and coordinated urban growth, which we communicated with Nick so strongly in the New Climate Economy report on better growth, better climate, not only means a big plus for, yes, the economy, and yes, for the climate, but it means to avoid excessive forms of peripheralization of the urban poor, which is socially unsustainable. We've done work in three emerging megacities, Sao Paulo, Istanbul, and Mumbai, where we looked at how poorer segments of the population can access daily services, including their jobs, and how long it takes compared to richer sections of the population. The difference in Sao Paulo, which is very car-oriented and sprawling, is at least double at already very high absolute levels. Poor people are on top of being sort of disadvantaged, punished in terms of access time. By contrast, more compact, more transit-oriented, Mumbai and Istanbul actually equalize that access across income groups quite elegantly. Now, social inclusion is actually a big driver for this sort of public transport policy we're seeing around the world. When bus rapid transit was invented in Curitiba and further scaled in Bogota, it was a strategy for more efficient and equitable transport. The now re-elected mayor, Enrique Peñalosa, who set up the Transmillennium bus system in Bogota in the late 1990s, he wasn't thinking about carbon at all. However, these systems not only produce several billions of benefits in efficient access to the cities and for its jobs, but are reducing carbon emissions by at least, I mean, these are sort of the latest estimates, by 500,000 metric tons annually in these BRT cities. And one final example, linking proactive citizenship and renewable energy, which is also referred as decentralized energy, which is a unique opportunity for local empowerment, not only at the level of individual PV units, photovoltaic units, or so-called citizen windmills, but at the scale of the city. The city of Munich owns its utility company, and because of that public ownership, they have set themselves a vision of becoming 100% carbon neutral with its electricity by 2025. That would have been impossible if it wasn't for public ownership. So all these examples just underscore a unique opportunity our cities provide us with to join up climate policy with other fundamental policy objectives.
Philip, thank you very much indeed. And I'm very, very glad that in that last contribution you got close to the democratic issues. because I mean, I think what we've heard is an exposition about the choices, not just about where people live in cities or in rural communities, but how people live. And I mean, what we've heard this evening is nothing short of a looming catastrophe and very clear trade-offs. You know, we need renewal of infrastructure, but while we renew infrastructure, we deteriorate further progress on climate change. And I think that this reflection on the engagement of citizens, people feeling that this is something they must own, the correlation between that being the behavior of people who are better educated in better paid jobs, while poor communities exercise very little choice. I mean, I know very well the community you refer to in Mumbai, which is an optimistic but subsistence community. And I wonder if you'd like to react, you know, perhaps Bruce, to this question about engagement, personal responsibility, intergovernmental legislation, national legislation. Where does the bite and the leverage come?
It's hard to mention national in the United States. You know, here's the issue. Cities are not governments. The national government is a government. States are governments. They can be hijacked by partisanship, and in most parts of the world they are. You know, the typical kind of ideological divisions. Cities are networks where you have not just representative democracy, but participatory democracy. And that's why a lot of the actions that we've all described, which again are not sufficient to have the kind of scale effect you want, are happening in cities. In the United States, what's essential for these kind of investments or regulatory reforms to happen is for people to make the argument, for leaders to make the argument, whether it's public, private, civic, or otherwise, that there's a jobs effect mm-hmm. and that there's a capital effect.
Yeah.
This is not just an environmental imperative, but these are the kind of actions that are going to create good and quality jobs that can be coupled with the kind of skills, training, and education to bring more people into the prosperous economy. So it is particularly important in the United States to make the environmental, economic, and social relationships, both in general at the policy scale, but at the granular level of geography.
Yeah.
And so I think that is happening. And, you know, frankly, when you go into any city, the kind of conversations that naturally occur in a very integrated way, that doesn't really happen at the national level or at the state level, because then there are governments. They have specialized agencies. They have specialized expertise. At the city level, it becomes mashed up across sectors, across disciplines. Mm-hmm. And so I think as we go forward here, cities obviously will invent many solutions. They'll innovate on products. But they're also going to send a signal higher up the food chain, so to speak. I actually think cities are at the top of the food chain, that there needs to be an integrated, holistic perspective, which you know, Nick and Karen really have laid out.
Yeah.
But is hard for, I mean, I was in the national government at the federal level for 10 years. Trust me, it is so specialized, it is so compartmentalized. The natural relationship between housing and transportation and environment does not occur. At the city level, how could it not occur? You live it every single day. Mm. So I do think that this network-driven perspective and this sort of integration of economic, social, and environmental solutions is fundamental to going forward.
Thank you. Nick?
I think we should also think of aspects of different kinds and often lower-level politics. If you look at how the auto rickshaws in Delhi changed to compressed natural gas. It was essentially a legal case brought by a number of people settled in the Supreme Court on the human right to breathe. And they demanded that the auto rickshaws and some of the buses and trucks change to compressed natural gas. And it happened pretty quickly. Everybody said it's never, you know, never going to work. The rickshaw drivers are going to stop. Excuse me.
Bless you.
Sorry. Are going to stop. It's the air pollution, isn't it? are going to stop everything. But it happened very quickly. I've done a lot of work in India over the last more than four decades, and there's one company called Selco, which operates in Karnataka, centered in Bangalore, one of the cities that Karen was focusing on. And they bring microfinance and small-scale solar to people. Much of it is in, some of it's in rural areas, but much of it's in cities. And those things change.
Yeah,
change,
exactly.
Understandings. So I think that type of event, you know, whether it's through the courts or it's through entrepreneurship,
sure,
can be extremely important in changing the way in which people understand and thus the politics.
Exactly. Karen?
Well, cities are not going to act on climate change in and of itself, right? I mean, I think one of the things that really resonated that Philip said was that it's all about what's happening at the local level. And in the climate change world, we think about co-benefits as these other things you get when you also mitigate climate change, right? You get better health, you get economic development. But that's the co-benefit, because your real aim is lowering emissions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But that's not going to make cities act or people act. Mm-hmm. People act because they want to live in better cities.
Exactly.
They don't want to be commuting 2 hours or 3 hours. They want to breathe the air. They want to be able to live in safe, pleasant, aesthetically pleasing places. And I think we need a change in language. Mm-hmm. Because the co-benefit, if we have sustainable urbanization, is actually mitigating climate change. I would argue that Jane Jacobs is maybe one of the first environmentalists.
Yes.
In terms of really linking cities and the environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you think about the small grid, the walkability, that's really all the features of low carbon human or urban settlements.
Yeah, maybe a follow-up. So I think they're absolutely right, and I think probably we need to move from co-benefits to mutual benefits, so we lose the directionality. But the question still remains, how can we inspire urban populations with what is possible and what would be so much better? And I think, you know, what I pick up a lot is this idea of we need to be more bold and do sort of trials and test certain things, expose people to new experiences.
So they exposing is critical.
They actually can, live this new situation. Has anyone, since we're doing lots of surveys, has anyone been to the car-free day in Paris a few weeks ago, which was a much happier event in Paris? No. No, well, there were a few. But, you know, those
back.
That commented on the experience of being in central Paris without any vehicles, out there with kids, with bikes, feeling safe, has been an amazing eye-opener for every single person who has been there. And very successful urban policies that were actually introduced over time go back to those initial moments of getting the buy-in by people emotionally connecting to a new idea how urban life can take place.
Yeah, thank you. Now, we're going to open this up to you. We've probably got time for four brief contributions, and we've got roving microphones. And what we're going to do is take four contributions, I mean literally 30 seconds each. Have you ever tried to express a view on climate change in 30 seconds? But tonight's your chance. And then I'm just going to ask each of our panelists just to respond to part of the aggregate group of questions. So who would like to start? Yes.
Hi. With the responsibility for carbon emissions already generated, falling more heavily on the Northern Hemisphere, what sort of direct transfer, either financially or technologically, should there be between cities in the Northern Hemisphere and cities in the poorer global south?
What was the question?
The north-south relations.
Yeah. Did you get that?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Gentleman here in the red jumper.
Sorry, I interrupted you. What was the question? Yeah, hi. Good night. One question maybe for the professor, Nicholas Stern. Regarding that climate change is the biggest externality, that some authors have said that, there are some ways to mitigate it, like taxes, but maybe there are other kinds, other ways to do it, maybe with people engagement or some economic behavioral movements that are born, like nudging.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Crispin. It's coming.
Oh, here.
Great, thank you.
We've heard some very good talks covering, I think, most of the field, but not all of it. One of the things people have not spoken about is the pressure of human proliferation. The increase in the human population bears directly upon all of this. And in my own feelings about this, I feel that the first element of trying to persuade not just people or governments, but local communities, is in fact to show that change is in their interest, that you have to be able to present things in such a fashion that it's in the interest of people to make the changes that we all think desirable.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor. And this is our last contribution. Thank you.
Could you comment on the relationship between economic inequality and the quality of the environment and the possibility it opens for mitigation?
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Right, Bruce, your starter.
I'll try to respond to this because I do think, again, American perspective, we're responsible for the crack up of the Great Recession. Post-recession, what you have seen is an attempt to return to the fundamentals of what drives a modern, sophisticated economy that can create more opportunities for a broader set of its citizenry. Well, what really drives this is advanced kinds of industries that are innovative, sustainable, and ultimately create more and better jobs. And then again, training and education that can complement that. The question, therefore, is can we begin to invest in the clean energy economy at scale through R&D, and then through new financial instruments, intermediaries, institutions around sustainable infrastructure, and the companies that generally are going to make the sustainable products and create the sustainable services. There is a positive, there isn't essentially an interplay here between innovation, sustainability, and inclusion that needs to be fundamentally understood.
Yeah.
And so at this point, I think this is really about norms of finance, and because again, it's not the old system of a national government basically doing what I said the first time, or in the first statement, set a price on carbon, tilt the playing field in this direction. That ain't gonna happen in the United States. It's going to have to happen in, you know, through the local and state financing of these disparate kinds of activities that in the end will create the more and better jobs that will send a clear signal that this is, you know, something that can relate to people's lives and should be fully politically supported.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I'm happy to reinterpret the question about, actually it was for Nick, about what other policies are out there. And I did hear you mentioned nudging. That's the one I leave for Nick. But I do think besides policies, particularly from a national level that are targeted at the individual, national governments need to take much more serious their frameworks with regards to how cities operate and how they respond. Yes, spatial planning is the number one sort of power of urban governments. But they are very much playing a game where the rules of the game are set in most countries at the national level through infrastructure finance and funding, and even related to questions around, developing new land for your local tax revenue, as we have heard it. And by the way, this is not just a story in China. It's actually a big issue in my home country, in Germany, where we still, with a stagnating population, are developing every day 73 hectares with a goal of 20 hectares. 73 hectares per day. So I don't know how many football, well, that's 73 football fields here. But just to give you an idea, per year, that equals more or less the land, the developed land of a city of Mumbai of 12 million people. Okay? And this happens in a country which is aware of the environmental issues, sophisticated democracy, a lot of environmental pressure, good urban planning. But the national frameworks are still not up to speed, incentivizing cities to operate in the right way.
Aaron? The question about cities in the north versus cities in the south and their relative responsibilities, I mean, absolutely, there are very different responsibilities and very different strategies going forward. Remember I said there are four main drivers of urban emissions: income or socioeconomic factors, technology, the economy, and then there's urban form. And for most cities in the, not North America, but really in the Northern Hemisphere, their urban form has already been built. And even though they're adding, they're really adding on the fringe. And so when we infill or when we change the urban form in these cities, it's really on the margin. For cities that are already developed, we have to look at those three other things. That's technology, changing our economy, and then changing our lifestyles.
Yeah.
For the developing country cities, it's a very different set of challenges and also opportunities. And I think this is where the scale of the population comes in. Because if you remember that slide that I showed with the upper middle income greenhouse gas emissions, almost at the same level as the higher income countries. So we're going to see that the aggregate effect of these emerging economies is going to be significant simply because of the sheer size.
Yeah.
And then there's the lock-in effect.
Thank you, Karen. Nick?
Can I take one or two things together? I mean, how far do people behave only in their own self-interest? How do you get people together to share the benefits of what are good actions for a group as a whole? And some parts of this story, I think it's remarkable how people do get together. I mean, the fact that you've got a meeting in Paris in a couple of weeks' time where people without a global government are getting together to try to do what collectively makes more sense is an example of groups getting together, going beyond some very, very narrow sense of self-interest and looking for a broader scope for community interest. So I actually think we do an injustice to people if we think they behave like the consumer in Economics 101 with a single narrow objective, perfect information about all the options and prices, and instant calculation of self-interest. Okay. People do get together in ways. And secondly, that's a sort of at a big scale. Incentives do matter, but people see bigger pictures. Another one is an example of getting people to share from the benefits of good infrastructure. And I know what, I buy my electricity from good energy, you should too. I have no shareholding in the thing. But they've been very good. A lot of it's wind, a lot of it's onshore wind. Yeah. Now some people don't like onshore wind. And what they do is they get local communities together to discuss how they can share in the benefits. Some cheap electricity, playing fields for the schools. So you can actually structure things in a way that people will see the advantages of acting together. It's a little bit like, although it's too mechanical, one of our LSE Nobel Prize winners, Ronald Coase, thinking about negotiations so that people get together to share the benefit. What you need, I think, is not simply the property rights and the negotiation. That's overly rigid in Ronald Coase. But you can get people to see common and shared interests and look beyond their own very narrow story. And good examples and good behavior can be catching.
Good. Thank you, Nick. Right, okay, quick fire. Optimist or pessimist?
Well, if you're...
Only optimist or pessimist?
If you're an urbanist, you're an optimist by definition.
I'll give the example of the reply of my great friend Yann Arthus-Bertrand, who made these wonderful books, The Earth from Above, which you've probably seen. And he said it's too late to be a pessimist.
Great. Karen, you've already told us.
Absolute optimist.
Good. Fabulous. Well, there you are. Listen, thank you all very much indeed. Happy birthday, LSE Cities, and thank you all for coming to the party.